Hello and welcome to the Pluralcast. This is your host, David Starr. And this episode, of course, includes a segment from Kate Gregory and her visual studio, Kung Fu. And then we get to talk with Liam McLennan, which is just a great name to say, isn't it? Liam McLennan about JavaScript. I had the good fortune this last week to attend and present at my very first European conference. I went over to Dev Week in London, and I've never actually spent any time in London. It was really, really cool. I learned a lot of things about how the English language separates these two groups of people, Americans and the English, which is probably as it should be. But I also learned about the perfect automobile. I have four kids, and I want a London taxi. They're incredible. They're the perfect example of design fit for purpose. I want a London taxi. So if you have a line on a London taxi somewhere here in the States, hook me up, will you? Now, in the meantime, let's get started with Kate Gregory's Visual Studio Kung Fu. Okay, well, as you all know, when it comes to tricking out Visual Studio, Kate Gregory is your friend. So, Kate, what do you have for us this time around?
Well, I want to talk to you about Pro Power Tools, Productivity Power Tools. I think it might have had a brief name in which Pro stood for something else, but its official name, Productivity Power Tools. But there's so much in it that I can't fit it all in one conversation. So I'll tell you some of it this time and some of it later.
All right.
Now, finding Pro Power Tools is easy. You know you can find any extension pretty much by going to visualstudiogallery.com and searching, but it lives in this kind of permanent place of honor. You don't need to search for Pro Power Tools. It's just always at the top of the middle column when you come into visualstudiogallery.com. So not a hard thing to find at all. And it's a bundle of extensions. The ones I want to talk to you about this time around are all related to things that are happening in the editor. First of all, I'm a huge GoToDefinition fan. You're looking at some method call and you're like, I wonder what that does. So you can right click, go to definition, and it takes you to the code for the function. Yay. It also works for seeing where some variable's been declared, that kind of thing. So control click go to definition on the surface shouldn't make much difference. All that happens is when you hold control and click on a method name or a variable or whatever, it does a go to definition for you. But what actually happens, thanks to some clever UI, when you hold down control and move the mouse over a method name, it changes it to be blue and underlined. And our brains all go, link, that must be a link. And we click and we follow the link. And sure enough, we see the method. And so it really changes my relationship to exploring around my code. Love control click, go to definition.
Okay, cool. So it sort of lights up my whole code file as almost like a web page where I can click things and navigate through, et cetera.
Right. Just as long as you have control held down while you're doing the mousing, because mousing in general over function names does other things, right?
Right.
That pops up some tips in that. So that's a sweet part of Pro Power Tools. I also, once you're used to it, really like the auto completion of all the things that come in pairs. So you type if round bracket, it types the close bracket, and then your cursor's between them. Or you're in some sort of a for loop, you type an open brace, it types the close brace, and your cursor is in between them. So you don't forget to close things.
Finally, thank you.
I had a series of muscle memories, sort of if, open bracket, close bracket, back arrow, and with braces involving hitting enter and moving up and down lines. And this is just, you know, less having to remember all the clicking around. It also has, and you can turn it off if you don't like it, but I like it, something called highlight current line, which especially, you know, if you have a huge screen and you're looking at 100 lines of code because you're in some tiny, tiny font, you can actually not be sure what line of the file your cursor is on, which is, you know, embarrassing if you then paste into the wrong place or whatever. So highlight current line just draws a background color on the line you're on so you know where you are.
Also, you just mentioned that it has all these features. Those features are individually configurable then?
That's right. You can go onto the tools options menu and turn on and off. So if it's making you crazy that it's closing your braces and brackets for you because you're still typing them, you can turn it off so that it stops doing that.
Ah, cool. All right.
Yeah. And the last kind of editor-related piece of the Pro Power Tools I want to talk to you about is fixing mixed tabs. So we all go to the great bathroom wall that is the internet from time to time to get code. And it's probably the least of our worries when you paste in code from random places, but some people are use tabs and some people use spaces to do their indenting. And it can look okay in Visual Studio, and then you copy it out into Word or email or something, and all of a sudden it's gross because the tab stops are different. So the Pro Power Tools will put an information bar across the top saying, hey, this file has got mixed tabs and spaces. Want to fix it up? And if you say yes, it fixes it up for you.
Is that what that is? I've had that installed for a while, and every once in a while that comes up, and I just think, what is that? Okay, great.
That's what that is.
Thank you.
So there you go. There's some of Pro Power Tools and how it can make you a more productive developer.
Mr. Liam McLennan is a web developer based in Brisbane, Australia. He works mostly with Microsoft tools and technologies, but has a tendency to veer off into some other fun things as well. Since 2006, he's been working with local startups, developing web-based products, and he even spent 5 years in that world that we all know and love so well, corporate IT. He blogs about software development at hackingon.net. And when not programming, for fun or profit, Liam likes to spend time outdoors sailing, hiking, or climbing mountains. He's a pretty rugged Australian, as they tend to be. Could you talk to me a little bit about the similarities, differences, where they join jQuery, Ajax, and JavaScript?
JavaScript is the programming language. So it's an interpreted language that runs in your browser, and as well, we now have some server-side environments where you can run JavaScript. jQuery is a framework written in JavaScript that's used to work with browsers, work with DOM objects in the browser, and also for Ajax. So Ajax refers to the technology that allows web pages to communicate with web servers without interrupting the user's experience. So it makes communication to the server in the background, so things appear to be more responsive.
Man, that was beautifully succinct. That was almost like you were expecting the question, and I happen to know you were not. You seem to be really excited about JavaScript, the language. What is there to be excited about?
Well, I think I admire it for its simplicity. It's a very small language. You get strings and arrays and half a dozen other objects, a few built-in functions, and that's about it. If you want namespaces or classes or any of the other things that a lot of other languages are burdened with, that's fine, but you have to construct it yourself out of the primitives that JavaScript gives you, which is pretty well just objects and functions. And even functions in JavaScript are just special objects. So yeah, I'm definitely excited about JavaScript. I think I've been predicting for a while that JavaScript's going to be the future for web development. I think server-side JavaScript is really going to take off, where at the moment we're mostly seeing JavaScript just in the browser.
So why is server-side JavaScript an appropriate technology? What is it that's going to make that different than coding in all of the other languages that we use?
Well, I think it's going to be very similar to coding in any of the server-side dynamic languages. So that's the biggest difference for me as a .NET developer, is that JavaScript is a dynamic programming language, and so that makes it very different to work in from, say, C#. It gives you a lot of power and flexibility, and also a lot of responsibility, because it's very easy to get yourself in trouble. In terms of differences between JavaScript and, say, working with maybe Ruby or Python on the server, I think that there's less differences, but I think that JavaScript is smaller and simpler. It has a bit less baggage, and also there's some tremendous technologies for hosting JavaScript on the server, and some really fantastic performance from things like Node.js and the various JavaScript runtimes that we get because they are working very hard on optimizing JavaScript for browser purposes, but then we can take that technology and use it on the server side as well.
So each browser that is able to work with JavaScript has its own interpreter built right in, yes?
Yeah.
And which one of those interpreters is the one?
I think they're all very good, or at least a number of them are very good. And there's a real arms race currently going on, particularly between V8, which is the the JavaScript interpreter that's part of the Chrome web browser and the JavaScript interpreter that's in Firefox. So there's quite regularly new releases coming out with quite substantial performance improvements on those two browsers. As far as I know, Internet Explorer is still a little bit behind, but they're definitely improving slowly. It's just great to see. From where I'm standing, I think it's wonderful because as a developer, I just get these constant performance improvements that I can take advantage of.
So as those interpreters are improved, is there also a trend toward evolving the language? Is JavaScript itself changing?
Yeah, absolutely. It's controlled by ECMA, and there's a lot of activity on the in the ECMA community to make changes to JavaScript, and I think it's quite controversial, and it's difficult too because of backwards compatibility concerns. I think that there also is this problem that they can change JavaScript as much as they like, but we as web developers still have to write JavaScript that's going to run in browsers that are 10 years old. But there's a lot of consideration to doing some fairly major changes to the language, as well as some minor changes to fix some of the problems.
How do those get released? Do they get released by ECMA as a language specification that then the interpreter creators need to implement?
Yeah, they do release specifications infrequently, but there's also much more, heated short-term discussions, and a lot of white papers get published, and there's a lot of sort of prototyped features that get thrown around and argued about. Some of those become available even if they're not exactly mainstream. So, for example, there's a lot of things implemented in Firefox's interpreter that you can't really use as a web developer because it's not supported in other browsers, but the features are kind of there, so there are a few versions ahead. And if you go to the Mozilla Developer Center, which has all the documentation for JavaScript, and you look through the objects and features that are available, they have information there about which version of JavaScript is required to use certain functions and things, so you know what you can use and still get support. So the sad part of it is there's a lot of really cool features that it's just not practical to use because we haven't got widespread acceptance in the browsers.
But I suppose if you had centralized control, if you were in a server-side environment, then you get to pick your interpreter. So
on the server side, yeah, you can just go nuts.
So one of the things that you immediately honed in on when I asked you about JavaScript was its dynamically typed nature. And, in my way of thinking, that simply means that X can be a string, X can be an int, and I'm going to find out at runtime. Why is that an important thing?
I think it just gives you a lot of power and flexibility because, traditionally we write code, we compile it, we deploy it, and it is how it was when we wrote it. A dynamic language gives you the ability to write a program that can modify itself at runtime. That sounds scarier than it is. One example that I can give you is we did a programming exercise once upon a time, and we were trying to write a linked list implementation. So this was kind of like a brown bag session at lunchtime. And one of the ways that you can do that in a dynamic language is you can just modify every object that gets put into your linked list and give that object a pointer to the next object. So you don't actually have to sort of wrap it in a collection or anything like that. You can just modify the actual objects themselves to point to each other. I'm not saying that's a good idea, but that is sort of the power that it gives you to be able to do those kind of things.
Okay, so that after I have some object spooled up in memory, I can go in and layer some new functionality into that object, even though it's already instantiated, and it'll get along just fine.
Exactly. Another good example is the ORM that's built into Ruby on Rails. So it creates your domain types on the fly at runtime by looking at the database. So if you change your database, your domain models magically changed as well. And that's only possible in a dynamic language.
One of the things that some folks will talk about when they talk about Java, not even necessarily JavaScript, but dynamic languages in general, is the need to support them with robust unit tests because we don't have that type checking and compiler time checking. So how do you do that in JavaScript if you're working in a client?
There is probably at least a dozen different testing frameworks available for JavaScript, that some of which are client-side, some of which are server-side, and some of which are both. There's one that is part of the jQuery project called QUnit, and you write your typical sort of unit tests written in JavaScript. You group them together into HTML pages, so when you open up the page, the tests get executed against your JavaScript code that you're testing, and you get a nice little typical sort of red-green report to show you the current state of your code. And because it's run in a web page, you can also use document object model objects as well as part of your test, so you can interact with the page and add rows into tables or do whatever it is that you need to do and test that that's all working properly as well.
And I can see those guys run right there inside the page that I'm actually building out. Is that the idea?
I certainly don't use it that way. If I do want to test some DOM manipulation, I'll copy that little bit of the DOM and put it into my test rather than putting my test into my actual code.
One of the things that struck me, because I, by the way, have gone in and looked at the Pluralsight on-demand course that you created for JavaScript, and there are some things in there that really jump out at me. And one of those is closures. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what those are and why or how they're manifested in JavaScript.
Well, closure is a language feature that you get in JavaScript and you get in a lot of other languages, including C#. My understanding of it is that when you declare a function in JavaScript, any of the variables that are in scope at the point where you declare that function become available inside the function, even if it's not immediately called, but even if it's if you assign that function to a variable and pass it around your application, the context in which it was created goes with the function. This can be a very powerful thing, and if you've ever used jQuery, you've used this quite a lot. You can do things like make an AJAX call and supply a callback function to be executed when the value is returned from the server. And within that callback function, you can reference variables that were in scope where that callback function is declared, even though maybe 10 seconds have gone by if it was a slow request, and that whole part of the application might have been cleaned up. But because of the closure, that scope information stays around. It's confusing and sort of difficult to explain without examples. In the course that you're referring to, there's quite a bit of code there that makes it a bit more explicit.
I have to say you did a really good job with that, not having a whiteboard.
Yeah, it's a tough one. But I think even C# developers are familiar with closure and use them all the time, but maybe without thinking about it so specifically.
One of the things that's been discussed here on the show recently is HTML5. And I'm wondering if there's anything in HTML that impacts JavaScript's implementation? Do those two technologies need to evolve together?
I think JavaScript is unfairly blamed for a lot of problems with HTML and with the document object model particularly. So I think that the impact will be that HTML5, hopefully this time, will get the document object model a bit better. So it might be more enjoyable to write JavaScript that automates, does things in the browser. But they are really disconnected technologies. JavaScript is just a programming language, and HTML is this markup language for generating interfaces. And I think that a lot of the problems where they intersect, a lot of the problems with the document object model, because we have jQuery, which is a fantastic library that kind of smooths out those issues and makes it much nicer for JavaScript to work with the DOM. But I think it's only a good thing.
And just to be clear, that DOM really, as I understand it, is just an API sitting on top of that markup.
That's exactly what it is, yes. And unfortunately, it's slightly different between all the different browsers. So that's one of the things that jQuery gives us, is a standard interface to work with.
Do you see the evolution of jQuery, the needs that jQuery has, being a primary driver behind the evolution of the JavaScript language itself?
I don't think so. I don't think that they really have that much power. In terms of like thinking about the evolution of jQuery, I do wonder where that's going to go, because if HTML5 fixes up some of the problems with the DOM, then maybe jQuery won't be quite as necessary as it is now. I think it's still going to be a very powerful tool always, but that will be one use case for which we won't require it anymore if we get a bit of standardization built into the browser.
Oh, we've mentioned at least, I think two or three times already, the notion of server-side JavaScript. And I'm just curious, have you actually done this? Have you done Hello World in server-side JavaScript?
I have. I'm very excited about the technology, and I've looked into it at the point where I have been working on new projects. And I have to say that I haven't dived in and actually built a real project with server-side JavaScript, because as much as I like the concept and there is some really interesting projects available, it really is a very immature technology, and I think at this point trying to actually build a real application with it is making your life a little bit difficult. But I think it's just a matter of time until some of those frameworks get to that next step where they're really usable, and then I think I'm going to jump into it with both feet, because I think it's going to be great.
So what are some of the tools that I can bring to bear? If I want to go try Hello World on server-side JavaScript, what is it that I'm going to set up and play with?
If you really just want Hello World in the sense of return a bit of text, you could do that with just Node.js, which is Node.js is a JavaScript runtime, but also built into or integrated with a network server. So you can set that up to handle HTTP requests and return text fairly easily. And there's a lot of frameworks that go on top of Node.js to give you a real web framework, often in the kind of Sinatra sort of style, where you define handlers for GET requests and POST requests and, you know, MVC style frameworks. That's probably the most popular path at the moment.
Okay, so Node.js, tell me about that. Is it an open source project? I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, it is an open source project. It's so they've taken the V8 JavaScript engine out of Chrome, and it does things a little bit differently. So it's got the network server stuff built into it as well, but it's based very heavily on this idea of doing things asynchronously. So all of the request response handling is by default is asynchronous. So typically you set up a handler for something, and then you assign some sort of callback to be run when the request is finished. And that goes all the way down the stack as well. So they've written asynchronous IO and everything so that in theory at least you can have like a whole request be handled without any synchronous steps in the process. And I understand that has some advantages for thread pooling on web servers and things like that, so you can get very high throughput.
Well, that definitely gives us all the hooks we need to go implement a real no-kidding web framework, as you were mentioning.
Yeah.
And so what are some of those web frameworks that do exist?
I believe there's one called Express that goes on top of Node.js. There is probably a dozen that I can't think of off the top of my head. I've sort of have briefly investigated them all and pretty well across the board decided that they're not sufficiently mature for my purposes just yet. I think they're very like bleeding edge, really. I think, yeah, definitely Express is one of the good ones. But there's quite a few. And there was a competition a while back called Node Knockout, which was to build some sort of a tool or a product or application using Node.js. And a lot of the entrants for that competition were web applications. So it's a good demonstration of some of these products that are out there and what people have been able to do with them.
I've seen people talking recently about CoffeeScript, which has something to do with JavaScript, but I'm not sure what that is.
That's a great question, David. So CoffeeScript is another thing that I really like and am quite excited about. So it is a JavaScript, sorry, it's a programming language with a very nice syntax that's sort of somewhere in between JavaScript and Ruby and Python, and it compiles into JavaScript. So you can write your JavaScript code in CoffeeScript and either dynamically or statically run it through a compiler, which generates JavaScript code that you can then use in a browser or on one of these server-side JavaScript engines.
Oh, man, why is this a good thing? That sounds like something where I'm coding my primary logic in T4 templates or something.
I think that there's two reasons why it's a good thing. One is the syntax is very spectacular. So they really have taken the best parts of JavaScript and the best parts of Ruby and the best parts of Python. It's beautiful to look at. But even if you're not so into that, it also has an advantage that there are a few things in JavaScript that are perhaps counterintuitive or don't work very well or just plain wrong. And by putting another layer on top of it, CoffeeScript is able to fix those problems. It makes you unable to access features that you shouldn't be using and things like that. And also it adds quite a few nice features to the language that JavaScript doesn't have.
Okay, I'm going to have to drill into that a little bit. So what are some of the things that JavaScript could improve on that CoffeeScript's helping it cover up?
Well, one of the classics is equality comparison. So, you know, as a Java programmer or a C# programmer, we're accustomed to being able to use the == operator to compare two things for equality. And if you do that in JavaScript, you sometimes get some very strange results because by default, that operator performs type coercion on the parameters, and so it tries to make them the same type and then compare them. So it will often tell you that things which aren't equal are equal. And so in JavaScript, we have a second operator, ==, which performs the equality operation without the type coercion and gives you a more accurate result. So what they did in CoffeeScript is that they've just made it so that you use == and you get the strict equality comparison, and there's no way to do the equality comparison with the type coercion, which is just really a very simple way to introduce bugs.
Oh, sure. I could see how it would be.
They've also added a nice syntax for looping over objects and inspecting the properties, which you can do in JavaScript, but CoffeeScript just gives you a nice syntax for that. There's also array comprehensions, so you can get away from using for loops all the time and write things in a little bit slightly more functional sort of style.
Okay.
And a whole heap of other really nice features. And so if you Google CoffeeScript, it'll definitely be the number one result.
Right on. Now, you've got a open source project of your own to help people learn JavaScript a bit.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Ruby Cohens project. I got this idea from them. So it's a set of failing tests that introduce a new language to somebody who's trying to learn it.
I have to tell my experience with that. I actually have gone through the Ruby Cohens here in Boise. We had Boise Code Camp last year, and Chris Bilson, who you may know, blogged on Elegant Code.
I do,
too.
Yes.
Yeah. He came and did a session on Ruby Cohens, and it was really cool. So it was, as you described, a set of failing tests that sort of taught the language to us progressively. And those of us in the room would come up and implement the code that would make a test pass and then move, and the next guy would come and sit down, and we rotate it. So together, we all got a little coding time.
Yeah, I think that it's a really fun way to get exposure to a new language and be introduced to some of its, you know, more interesting features. So I really enjoyed the Ruby Cohens as well, and I found myself in Tamworth, a little country town in Australia, one weekend, sitting around with a lot of spare time. So I sat down and I wrote a JavaScript equivalent of the Ruby Cohens. So the languages are different, so I looked at different aspects and different features, but the theory is the same. It's a set of failing tests. They start out very simple, and they add complexity as you go. And I think if you have experience with JavaScript, people can generally finish the whole project in about half an hour, and probably take a little bit longer if you are genuinely using it as a learning tool, and these things are new to you. It's written in such a way that hopefully it guides you to ask some questions and maybe try out some other things. Since you've got this executing JavaScript code there, you can change it as you like and do a little bit of experimentation as you're going through.
Have you had an opportunity to actually see people use it, or do you know of people who have used it and learned a little bit with it?
I introduced it to the guys at the Brisbane Alt.net user group. So we went through it a little bit there. And I also have talked to a few other people who've gone through it. The most interesting one was a friend of mine who did it. He completed the Coens on the train on his Android phone. Since all you need really is a text editor and a browser, so it's technically possible, but it must have been quite something.
Okay, very cool. Well, give us where we go to find that,
because it's on my GitHub account. So if you search on GitHub for JavaScript Coens, or even just a Google search for JavaScript Coens, ought to do it.
Well, all right, man. Thanks very much. I appreciate the passion that you've got around this. You actually were invested enough to go and build a system for other people to learn it. That's pretty cool.
It's been a lot of fun. It's also been the first open source project that I've done where I've had other people submit patches and things like that and started to work with GitHub. And that whole process has been heaps of fun. So I've definitely got something out of it.
Oh, I'm very curious. Anytime I hear that someone is the owner of an open source project, I like to hear about that experience. What's it like, the difference, say, between owning the code that you have at work during your 9-to-5 and owning the code that you have in your open source project? How do those two things differ for you?
Well, I mean, it's been great. I really enjoy it because it's not something that anybody's getting paid to do. So when someone submits a patch, it's because, you know, they were interested in this project. It's very exciting. You get this patch, and the way that GitHub works is fantastic, and you can see all the different commits that they made and the lines of code that have been changed and all that. So I just love getting patches. It's like getting something really exciting in the mail.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Well, thank you. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm sure the novelty probably wears off eventually, but at this point, it's still great.
I don't know. Linus is still rocking the Linux. Maybe maybe that's a new way of life.
Yeah, and I read that one of his motivations behind creating Git was to make this whole process of accepting patches and merging them in easier. And it definitely is really seamless.
Oh, and that you have found that to absolutely be the case since you're using Git on your back end.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right on.
It's great.
Liam, thanks so much for joining us, man. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for joining me for yet another episode of the Pluralcast. If you have any ideas about the show, send us a note. Head on over to cast.pluralsight.com. Let us know what you think. As always, thanks go to our musicians, specifically Patrick Lee, who you can learn more about at patrickleemusic.com, and the Judies, who live at wastedtalentrecords.com. This has been your host, David Starr, and I look forward to seeing you in class sometime soon.
Don't be a hippie. Don't be a hippie. And now I realize that there is no need for peace and love, brotherhood and harmony. This is the modern world. Let's pour more concrete. No protest is best. Don't be a hippie.